A very warm welcome to Midori House Live from Studio One here at Monocle headquarters in London with me, Tyler Brûlé. Over the next hour, we'll be getting a first look at what's making headlines in the dailies across the Asia-Pacific region, and we'll be checking in with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who's on assignment in Ankara.
There's a lot of anger over the quality of the buildings in Van, that the building regulations weren't met, and that this is why there's been so many deaths.
That was our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. And a little later in the program, we'll be talking to our correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith, off the back of her interview with the Vice President of Zambia. All that and a bit of fashion advice right here on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Chancellor Angela Merkel warned Europe not to be complacent about its peace and prosperity today, as German lawmakers approve plans to boost the firepower of the Eurozone Rescue Fund ahead of an emergency EU summit. Addressing a packed parliament before the vote, Merkel urged the lower house Bundestag to fulfil its historic duty and said Europe was in its toughest phase since the end of World War II. EU leaders are meeting to try to agree a range of measures to tackle the spiralling Eurozone debt crisis, but the prospects of a comprehensive deal look dim, with disagreements remaining in several crucial areas. Turkey is struggling to provide shelter for tens of thousands left homeless by the earthquake that's killed nearly 500, and rescue teams began taking painful decisions to call off searches for those buried alive. 3 days after the 7.2 magnitude quake shook eastern Turkey, demolishing 3,000 buildings, rescue workers pulled out alive a 27-year-old woman and an 18-year-old student from a collapsed building in Erciyes, the town hit hardest. A Japanese medical team arrived in Van to treat injured quake victims in a bid to repay Turkey's aid efforts when the country suffered from a devastating earthquake and tsunami earlier this year. The team included this nurse.
March, a big earthquake happened in Japan. So then many Turkish people came to our country and they helped me. So we are so happy and we never forget your kindness. Today is our turn, so we came here.
Brazil's sports minister Orlando Silva is expected to resign today over a corruption scandal in which he's accused of taking kickbacks on public contracts. Silva will be the sixth minister to resign this year and the fifth to step down over ethics breaches that have become a major headache for President Dilma Rousseff in her first year in office. The International Criminal Court said today it had no confirmation that Saif al-Islam, the son of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, and former intelligence chief Abdullah al-Sanusi are proposing to hand themselves over to the War Crimes Court. Earlier, a senior Libyan military official with the National Transitional Council said Saif and al-Sanusi are proposing to hand themselves into the Hague-based court. Libya's interim leaders hope to ask the Security Council to end UN authorization for a no-fly zone and NATO intervention by October the 31st. We need a few days to decide, according to a Libyan UN envoy. At the start of a UN Security Council briefing, Ian Martin, the UN envoy to Libya, expressed concerns about human rights violations and war crimes as the fighting neared its end in Libya.
Under the Gaddafi regime, Libya accumulated the largest known stockpile of shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles, known as MANPADs, of any non-MANPADs-producing country. Thousands were destroyed during NATO operations. But I have to report to you our increasing concerns over the looting and likely proliferation of MANPADs, as well as munitions and all sorts of mines in large numbers, with the most serious potential local and regional implications.
And finally, the head of Olympus, Tsuyoshi Kikukawa, resigned today after a scandal over hefty advisory fees wiped out half the 92-year-old firm's market value, while his successor stuck with the company's line that it had done nothing wrong. Sources told Reuters that Japan's securities watchdog was looking into past Olympus takeover deals, focusing on whether it has properly disclosed relevant information. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks for that, Nick. If ever a rather lethal weapon needs a bit of rebranding, it's MANPADs, I think.
Didn't like that at all.
Yeah, I think EADS or someone needs to completely rethink that. Let's go over to Thomas Schaffernacker with the weather now.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Mild and damp with a bit of sunshine, that pretty much sums up most of Europe, and there's absolutely no sign of any cold weather returning to anywhere in Europe, not even next week. Scandinavia and Eastern Europe also have the mild conditions, so the mild air is pretty much everywhere. And of course, we have the rain. Portugal and Spain will be particularly wet Wednesday into Thursday. So on to the business centre's forecast then as we head into Thursday. London, sunshine with more passing showers, 14 degrees the high. Frankfurt, a couple of days of sunshine, highs of 13. In Geneva, it'll be sunny, 14 Celsius on the thermometer. In Moscow, a bit colder, 6 degrees, and it'll be fairly overcast. And air travel across the Atlantic, all westbound flights to the US and Canada will more or less need to cut through the jet stream. In the past couple of days, the jet stream has been meandering almost like a snake on a sand dune as it comes out of North America. And at its core, 30,000 feet up through Wednesday, it's been raging at 160 knots or nearly 300 kilometers an hour. There's bound to be plenty of potential for mid-air turbulence at some point or another. But of course, rarely are transatlantic flights this time of the year quiet anyway. Now let's go over to North America and a snowstorm affecting Colorado. It's hit Denver and several inches of snow likely by the end of Wednesday. And this snowy blast has come very, very early in the season actually across Colorado. Meanwhile, more warm weather over the southern states all the way from the mid-Atlantic seaboard. Washington as well, still on the warm side, but the outlook for Washington is that it's going to get quite a bit colder in the next few days. So the business center's forecast then, Wednesday into Thursday, Washington DC 20 Celsius, but by Thursday it's only down to 12 degrees and it will be quite wet too. New York City, both days, that's Wednesday and Thursday, is wet, 17 down to 12, so New York's getting colder. And in Denver, just above freezing on Wednesday, 3 to 6 inches of snow, perhaps even some power outages. Now from the teeth chattering to the tropical, Miami at 29 on Wednesday with sun and tropical showers. And the air travel, well, clearly with the snowy weather over Colorado, airport disruption is on the cards. Denver has already been affected. The rest of the US, well, the strong jet stream on the US-Canadian border and around the Great Lakes, that means all flights headed across eastern Canada to Europe are in for a bumpy flight, at least at times. Let's head over to the Caribbean now, because there is trouble in the tropics. Currently, we have powerful Hurricane Rita between the Yucatan Peninsula and Jamaica, 110 mile per hour winds. Unfortunately, it's likely to hit Cancun by Thursday evening local time, and then the storm should head out into the Gulf of Mexico, posing a threat to western Cuba by Friday, and maybe South Florida over the weekend. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, as the rescue and recovery effort continues in and around Van in eastern Turkey, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, has been in Ankara talking to the country's president, Abdullah Gül. We caught up with him a bit earlier for the latest on the government's efforts to coordinate the rescue. Do you get any sense of urgency? You're at Ankara Airport as we're speaking. You've just come from the presidential palace. Is there a sense of urgency surrounding the situation in Van?
There is, yes. And I think, you know, initially they turned down the offer of foreign help because they thought everything was going to be okay. But as the situation's got a bit worse over the last couple of days, they've opened their doors to help from foreign countries. And there's one of the interesting things that came out from talking to the president and also to other people in Istanbul and Ankara over the last day or so, there's a lot of anger over the quality of the buildings in Van that are... that building regulations weren't met, and that this is why there's been so many deaths, because a lot of buildings have collapsed which really shouldn't have.
Is the government being quite proactive in their response in terms of what next measures will be, or are they still, you know, more engaged with just the recovery process right now?
Well, I think at the moment their focus is on the recovery phase, but they've been incredibly strong in their language they've used to describe those responsible for building these buildings, for supervising, for turning a blind eye to the regulations. That the Prime Minister today has referred to them as saying they essentially have a hand in murder for turning a blind eye to this. Now, when I spoke to the President, he wasn't quite as strong, but there's certainly a lot of anger that these rules haven't been followed. What steps they'll take to ensure they are followed in the future is still up for debate, but certainly at the moment the focus is just on rescuing as many people as possible.
Let's turn to the rescue effort because, as you cited at the top of this, Turkey, at the start of the week, they said that they did need outside assistance. Now they do. Who are they turning to, and is there a list of what is incoming and also who they're accepting assistance from?
They're accepting assistance from anyone who can offer it. So, for example, Israel offered assistance at the very start, and they were, like everyone else, turned down. Their help has now been accepted, although Turkey are quite keen to point out that this is, they don't think this is going to necessarily soothe those relations with Israel just because they've offered help on this. There's, I think, a little bit of a way to go before any earthquake diplomacy really takes place.
Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor on assignment in Ankara, thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much, Tyler.
We're going away for a short break. We'll be back right after this. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, sometimes it's hard to ask for help, even in an emergency. While Turkey declined emergency assistance earlier in the week, the country is now welcoming rescue and logistics teams from around the world, as you heard in an earlier news report. After a lengthy honeymoon period, Turkey and Israel have been at odds ever since Israeli commandos stormed a Gaza-bound flotilla last year. But nevertheless, the Ankara government has accepted Israeli assistance. Our editor, Andrew Tuck, spoke to Josh Hantman, spokesman for the Israeli Ministry of Defense, about the role the country is playing.
Josh Hammond, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, I understand that Turkey has said it is now willing to take some assistance as it searches for both survivors and also begins to try and provide some temporary housing for the people who have been left homeless by the quake. What will Israel be offering in the first instance?
So right now we're responding to a very particular request. Our Prime Minister and our President and indeed our Minister of Defence have all offered a very broad array of aid. But what they've specifically asked for is housing, temporary housing, portable structures, anything to keep these people who've lost their homes, to keep them warm and to keep them protected and covered. So that is what they requested right now, and that's what they're going to get.
So you're not sending any personnel across the border at this time, but I know that the Israelis have an amazing national search and rescue team that is actually very well equipped to deal with finding people in earthquakes.
Indeed, our search and rescue team is some of the best in the world. And back in 1999, when there was a Turkish earthquake, sent a really large delegation and we built a whole village from scratch. And this time, well, I believe it's been a long time since 1999, and the Turkish capabilities have certainly improved. And this time around, they're just asking for this specific type of aid. And of course, we respect that. We'll offer as much as possible, and we'll try and get as much as possible, as quickly as possible, over to Turkey.
And how has Israel built up this skill base over the years? What is it about Israel that means that they can provide this housing, that you're so skilled at dealing with earthquakes?
Well, it's not necessarily we do lie on a plate boundary, but actually, I suppose the amount of investment in our research and development into this field has been huge over the years. And necessity is the key to creativity. And over the years, with the amount of wars and battles this young country's had to fight, we've had to become skilled in all sorts of fields. And search and rescue, of course, is key in any battle and any war. And so over the years, we've developed an expertise in the field. And of course, as part of the ethos of this country and the value we attribute to life, and if we can help other countries, of course we will do it. And we're very proud of that.
Now, I know that when we came to meet the National Search and Rescue Unit last year, there was a figure that actually 90% of earthquake survivors are found within the first 24 hours. So in your opinion, is it too late anyway to send in people to search the rubble?
Again, we're going to provide anything that they want in terms of search and rescue, in terms of housing. We are put ourselves really, really on the plate for Turkey and said, use us as much as you want or as little as you want. And right now, it's warm clothes and mattresses and rugs. And the portable structures we're sending are also, actually, they're ready-made. They're built. They're going on 747. They're already connected up with electricity. There's going to be some logistical issues to transport them all the way there. But we believe this is the most quick and efficient way of housing people and keeping people warm in Turkey right now. That's the specific type of aid they've requested, and that's what we're providing.
And out of interest, will it be military aircraft that will be used to take equipment into eastern Turkey?
Actually, for efficiency, we're using a decked-out 747, a civilian 747 that the Ministry of Defence has hired, and we think that that is the most efficient way of getting these large portable structures over as soon as possible. And indeed, the first plane will be leaving today, the first of many planes.
So that's going to be a shuttle service that runs over the next few days, taking the equipment in.
Again, we're waiting for the final estimate, but at least three planes will be going in the next few days, and hopefully many more. We're cooperating very closely with the Turks, and close cooperation is always good. And hopefully we can get as much aid as possible over to Turkey in the next few days.
And can I ask you a more general question? Obviously, there have been slightly complicated relationships for various reasons between Turkey and Israel in recent months. Do you hope that something like this can be a way of kind of offering a kind of an olive branch, or a way of finding a way of talking to each other that's a bit easier?
Well, as I mentioned, close cooperation is always good. I don't think anyone can doubt that. However, when we see natural disasters such as this, we've put the focus on the humanitarian effort and really go beyond politics. And over the last few days, I think we've all realised that we have to get beyond politics and do our utmost and do our very best in order to save as many lives and now keep as many men, women and children in Turkey who have lost their homes warm. And yeah, this is our focus right now. We're moving beyond politics right now.
Josh Hammond, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
And that was our editor, Andrew Tuck, talking to Josh Hantman from the Israeli Defense Ministry. We'll be back with a look at the news stories that are breaking across Asia right now. We're back in a moment with Midori House.
You can now listen to the Monocle 24 as it was engineered to be heard on a radio. Monocle's design team has been working with the talented people at Revo Technologies in Scotland to develop a special edition of their Heritage G2 radio. It's capable of streaming in thousands of web-based radio stations. The Revo Heritage also pulls in FM, DAB and can dock iPods and iPhones. With its elegant aluminium and walnut finish, the special edition Heritage's best feature is an M24 button that will take you direct to our live stream. You can buy your Monocle 24 Revo Heritage at shop.monocle.com or through our stores in London, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo and Osaka. The Monocle Revo Heritage G2 for easy, elegant listening.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 and our Asia-Pacific News Roundup. And I'm joined by our editor. I was going to say editor-in-chief, but you're not. That's my job. But anyway, my colleague Jonathan Openshaw, whose program The Entrepreneurs is up next right after this program. But first, we should have a look at what's been making news across Asia. One of the ones that actually grabs my attention, which I'm sure might make some voters in Japan happy, the Asahi Shimbun is reporting that Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda is to take a 30% pay cut to push tax hikes. So I think it's an interesting trade-off that 30% off of his salary in exchange for 11.2 trillion yen in tax hikes. That is, it translates to $147 billion. And a lot of that is of course, going to a very good cause, which is post-quake reconstruction work. He also plans to reduce the pay of cabinet ministers and senior vice ministers by around 20%.
It's just a drop in the ocean, isn't it? But I guess it sends out a strong message.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't know if you caught this one as well, which is it's been floating around for a while, and it would actually be very good to get someone in from the Japanese government to talk about these 10,000 free airfares that are being offered around the world to stimulate tourism. And this is being done by the Japan Tourism Agency. Looking at the bill that's going to come with it, 1.1 billion yen. But I'm sure that it's going to make a lot of airlines happy, and particularly ANA now that they got their new 787 into the air between Tokyo and Hong Kong earlier today. Mm-hmm. What have you seen?
Well, yeah, so those are obviously the big stories. I mean, the Olympus thing for me is still huge and just kind of seems to deepen and deepen as we read. It's just watching a company like Olympus turn itself inside out.
Yeah, particularly after they, you know, they have, you know, an extraordinary array of products. You know, it's a much loved brand, and not just, you know, a loved brand when it comes to, you know, what they're known for most, which of course is photographic equipment. But it also seems that, you know, every interview you go into, you forget. Okay, yes, a lot of people use their iPhones today, but just, you know, their stranglehold on the dictaphone and small recording device business as well, and a company which has had some very good releases, but suddenly, you know, this whole thing you've just seen, you know, so much of the company, you know, not quite capsized yet, but it's pretty ugly. And then, you know, today, of course, Tsuyoshi Kikukawa, as we were saying earlier, you know, being demoted, you know, to from his directorship position as well.
I think it's the way it's playing out in public so much as well, that there's, you know, there's been these very public statements of animosity between the former CEO and current CEO, and it's almost, you know, in a very kind of un-Japanese show of the restraint is not here anymore.
No,
gloves
absolutely.
Are off. This is really,
yeah,
this is...
and to see the former CEO, you know, he's talking from London, and you have everyone huddled down in Tokyo, and it is a very ugly display. The other interesting one, just as the hacking issues continue, just staying in Japan for a moment, the Asahi Shimbun is saying that hackers target Japan's lower house. The story goes straight to, of course, the culprits potentially. So the cyber attack on the lower house computer network, which originated from a server in China, likely gave hackers access to a special password that enabled them to manipulate data on the server computer and all PCs connected to the system, which is, you know, quite remarkable when you're talking about the lower house of parliament in Japan.
Mm. And they've identified the source straight away as coming from, you know, across the East China Sea.
Yes.
Which for Japanese, you know, Chinese relations, obviously.
Not great.
Not the best.
And then there's another one here, which is, I'm not sure, you know, what would, you know, where would be more profitable, but the scientists are developing a dual arm clothing assistance robot. So, you know, with, you know, Japan, of course, challenged by, you know, a growing silver society, a graying market, and also the, you know, the other side of it as well is all of the issues in terms of caregiving in Japan. It's, you know, all, you know, every year you read stories about, you know, Filipinas who try to pass these language tests in Japan, and they're almost impossible for, you know, for many Japanese, you know, to pass as well. It is the most, you know, complicated, you know, array of tests that you have to go through. And whenever I speak to, you know, to colleagues, certainly our bureau chief, Fiona, she says, you know, it's amazing. She goes, you know, you could give that to, you know, probably, you know, many an average man or woman on the street, and they wouldn't be able to, you know, understand the vocabulary and even sort of, you know, it's almost sort of, a lot of it is quite archaic Japanese. So what this does is it prevents, you know, a lot of you know, immigrant, you know, nurses, etc., from being able to stay on in Japan. So
bringing the robots.
Yeah, time to bring in the robots. And this
you
one
have to
is
think
saying,
whether the kind of idea of a caregiving robot is a bit of a kind of oxymoron, really.
Yeah, it's a scientists say they've developed a caregiving robot that can dress a patient after adjusting its movement through trial and error. I'm wondering if it might have you know, bigger applications and maybe a shadier trade, which is perhaps undressing people, maybe.
Robot prostitution.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. A new Straits Times in Malaysia, out of Kuala Lumpur, two stories. Everyone must be very happy at Kuala Lumpur International Airport, as traffic figures are up quite significantly, to the tune of a double-digit increase. But this the other one is a company called the NASA Group, which is Malaysia's biggest luxury vehicle importer, is seeking to draw both local and foreign investors. They want to build a 100-story-plus tower, potentially. So they've got a significant plot of land that they're looking at. And I guess they want to give the Petronas Towers a run for its money.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, both like huge statements of intent for the region as well. I wonder how the knock-on for kind of Changi and the likes are.
Yeah, well, it's interesting also because, you know, we've seen a lot of changes, I think, within the aviation sector in Malaysia in particular. You know, if you look back probably 10, 15 years ago, you know, Malaysian Airlines was really, you know, was on quite an aggressive footing. It was spending a lot of money on promotion, etc. They've now gone a little bit quiet. So you wonder if there will be a bounce back. There's a lot of management changes. And so, yeah, and just seeing these traffic, you know, the traffic increase. And, you know, Malaysia, you know, of course, you know, being a Muslim country, they've also worked very hard at trying to market themselves, of course, to the Gulf you know, and of course, Indonesia and elsewhere as well. So, I mean, that's probably also part of the jump that we're seeing there.
Hmm.
And Sydney Morning Herald, anything catch your eye?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a huge kind of snap up in prime office space in Sydney. They've just reported more than $1.1 billion worth of prime office space has changed hands in the past 9 months. So this is, you know, this is at a time when around the world property prices are collapsing.
Absolutely, and
I think incredible figures.
Yeah, if you look at the CBD in Sydney as well, that you know, there's again. Not a shortage of, you know, of major international players who are looking, you know, particularly look at energy companies, etc. You know, who want to have more swish offices. So you can see why, you know, these are the types of numbers that are changing hands.
It was interesting as well. It's that 66% of these buyers were Asian based. So absolutely. I mean, that speaks volumes, doesn't it, about Sydney, how it's repositioning its place in the world as this kind of European gateway to Asia.
Absolutely. We're just going to take a short little break here. We're going to be back in a moment, and Jonathan's going to stick around and tell us what's on the program tonight.
I will be.
You are with Midori House. We're about 4 minutes away from catching up on the headlines with Nick Kelly, but in about 34 minutes from now, we're going to be hearing your lovely bass tones when you sign on with edition number 2 of The Entrepreneur. What's on tonight's program?
So we're taking a bit of a kind of focusing on the made-in brands, looking at kind of a resurgence in regional craft that's happening around the world. So we are leading with a package that I did last week going up to Stoke-on-Trent, obviously looking an area.
Big long haul trip for you.
Yeah, huge. you know, it's the red eye. And so looking at an area that has this incredible craft history, but it's been completely kind of devastated, turned into a post-industrial morgue, really.
Really?
And looking at the kind of small players who have gone back up there, who are kind of tapping into the heritage and a real bit of kind of beautiful storytelling in a new business.
Well, I think most of our listeners would know that Stoke-on-Trent is best known for having a very strong ceramics heritage, and this the UK's, you know, really most famous and premium brands were all based up there, at least the manufacturing
well,
is based there.
And all of those huge kind of Staffordshire pottery brands who were kind of ruled. It was the centre of ceramics production in the world, really, for 200 years.
So what? I don't want you to give it away, but as a small preview, I mean, what does it look like now? And you just have these massive, you know, plants that are just completely shut down, derelict.
Yeah, very much so. So the new owners at Wedgwood, for example, they've gone through a steady process of outsourcing, you know, for the last few decades.
Is Wedgwood making anything there anymore?
There is they've kind of still got a foothold, but it's very much kind of, and it's a token effort. And really, there's just a huge Wedgwood factory.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, the city itself has been, you know, economically devastated for sure. So it's this odd situation where there's these kind of ghosts of Victorian kilns dotted around everywhere, but very little production happening. But we met one of the small scale producers who's, you know, come up from London, spotted an opportunity to kind of breathe a bit of life back into some of these loved brands. And, you know, their business has been growing, you know, in the first couple of years, triple figure growth. And now it's stabilizing, but the solid and with ambitions to break into new foreign markets and just really kind of tighten what the brand means and sell it to the world again, which is an amazing thing to see.
Do you think there's that realization, is the realization about the importance of Stoke-on-Trent more in Asia or even you know, in corners of the US market, whereas maybe, you know, many people here, they don't really care. I mean, aside from job losses, they're not really bothered about where their teacup or saucer comes from.
I think it's a more general thing. I mean, Stoke's just an example that we focused on, but then we expand out in the show, even talking about new branding initiatives that happened, for example, San Francisco with the San Francisco Made Scheme that they launched last year, and Copenhagen Made Scheme, which is going to be launching towards the beginning of next year. And so I think it's more about a realization that there's a real hunger amongst consumers now to kind of look beyond the logo, that it's not really just about kind of finding the cheapest price point anymore, especially when, you know, the wages in developing markets aren't actually as competitive as they used to be. So that advantage isn't even there. And so now it's more about how you can really tighten up what the provenance of your product is and how you can, yeah, sell that abroad and make kind of communicate messages.
Just before we wrap up, is there a concerted effort, though, to actually look at whether it's a made in Stoke-on-Trent brand and does it have government backing? I mean, is there really a confederation who's pushing this in the same way as what we've seen in Copenhagen and San Francisco, or is it still a little bit more grassroots?
It's still more grassroots. It's slightly
slightly looser. There have been major steps. There's now a ceramics biennale, which is in its second year and just happened. So there are things happening, but I don't think it's quite been cottoned onto by kind of central government in the same way that we've seen in other countries.
Great. We'll be tuning in at 1900, Jonathan. Thanks for that. Oh, I like that little drum roll at the end. It's just approaching the bottom of the hour here. Well, it's actually a little past the bottom of the hour here at Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll be talking about the anatomy of a Monocle fashion shoot. But first, time to check in with Nick Kelly with the headlines.
Thanks, Tyler. EU leaders are meeting to try to agree a range of measures to tackle the spiralling Eurozone debt crisis. But the prospects of a comprehensive deal looked dim, with disagreements remaining in several crucial areas. More details at the top of the hour. Turkey is struggling to provide shelter for tens of thousands left homeless by the earthquake that has killed nearly 500, and rescue teams began taking painful decisions to call off searches for those buried alive. Brazil's sports minister Orlando Silva is expected to resign today over a corruption scandal in which he is accused of taking kickbacks on public contracts. The International Criminal Court said today it had no confirmation that Saif al-Islam, the son of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, and former intelligence chief Abdullah al-Sanusi are proposing to hand themselves over to the War Crimes Court. At least 20 people died in clashes and strikes which paralysed parts of Syria as President Bashar al-Assad met Arab ministers seeking to end months of violence, and authorities held a mass rally to show support for him. Somalia said today it had not agreed with Kenya for its troops to enter the south of the Horn of Africa nation to fight Islamist rebels, but would form a security committee to work with Nairobi. Still in Somalia, gunmen have abducted three aid workers in northern Somalia. An American woman and her Danish and Somali colleagues were snatched as their convoy headed to the airport yesterday. And up to eight people are believed to have been killed in flash flooding in northern Italy. The water has swept through five towns on the Ligurian coast, a region popular with tourists. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks for that, Nick. And you will be, you've penned another little piece for us. I thought we were going to make it a regular Friday thing, but it ties in with what's very much in the top of the news right now. Should we save that for the Daily later on?
Yes. Okay.
If you like.
Yeah. We'll save it for the Daily tonight.
It's European week.
I know. It's definitely European week. And I'm going to have that on my show tomorrow morning.
Good.
Okay. Excellent. See you a little bit later.
All right.
Yeah, here you're here with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. As we start to put our bumper December-January issue to bed, we'll be checking in with our editors and correspondents to preview some of the pieces they're working on. Alex Duval-Smith just wrapped up an interview with Zambia's Vice President, Guy Scott, and she joins us on the line now from Johannesburg. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Tyler.
How are you?
I'm fine. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you. I think we're catching you actually at Joburg Airport, are we not?
I am indeed. I'm at Joburg Airport about to fly to Cape Town where I live. I've met Sir Guy Scott, the new Vice President of Zambia, in Johannesburg today. He's on his way to to Australia for the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit with his wife. He's only been a Vice President for a month, and the new President, Michael Sata, has decided to send him as his deputy to represent the country.
Let's rewind for a second. Tell us why this story caught your attention and ours.
Well, it's a little bit simplistic, it would seem, to just say that the man's interesting because his skin is white, which it is. But that is, in Southern Africa, a very interesting step. The context in the region, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and often the subtext in the region is of an anti-white sentiment, a sentiment that connects white skin with colonialism and with ill-gotten gains, if you like, of the past. Now, here we have in Zambia, a man who's come along who's Zambian, who was born in Zambia, who's a former farmer and economist, actually also has a PhD in robotics. He's a very interesting man, 67 years old, and capable of actually entering politics, fighting a campaign with the new Patriotic Front and sweeping away a traditional party and winning a respectable score last month, so respectable that Michael Sata, the new president, has decided, well, one of his first moves is going to be to appoint a white deputy president, vice president.
Let's look at, two elements, and clearly it goes beyond symbolism because this is a man for the job. But domestically, how has this been received so far?
Well, with great enthusiasm, as I think that the Zambians I've spoken to are sort of quite touchy about the sort of foreign and regional interest in Guy Scott's skin colour, and constantly say, no, will you stop going on about it? He's Zambian. He's actually a black man in white skin. To us, we don't see the difference. But it's difficult not to pick up on that, because in the context of the region, of course, racial battles have been what have formed the history of this region for the last 50 years. So I asked Guy Scott today what it is about Zambia that means that it's ready, if you like, now that it's come around to its fifth president since independence in 1954. Why is that country more ready, perhaps, than others to actually see whites back in politics? And someone like Guy Scott, who's actually now the most powerful white man in African politics, well, he said to that, effectively, Zambia's trodden a slightly different route from other countries in the region. It was a protectorate of Britain, so it wasn't settled and occupied in the same way as the other colonies. It wasn't made to be a breadbasket to feed the rest of the empire. It was just expected to produce food for the copper miners, who were, of course, British. And as such, it's managed to move forward perhaps rather more quickly. And I think that's very interesting, because I think Guy Scott may be setting a trend.
And the fact that the president is sending him to Australia for a Commonwealth meeting, is that also, do you think, symbolic, you know, in another way as well, that that this is, you know, we're obviously talking about it, but it is sending out a different signal to the rest of the world as much as the Commonwealth?
I think there might be a bit of that. I think there might also be an element of President Sata is extremely busy. He's on a crusade to stamp out corruption and to get the civil servants working and to put people in jobs that actually know how to do the jobs. So he's a busy man. And then Guy Scott, yes, his wife is British. Her name's Charlotte Harland. She's been working up until now for UNICEF. She's extremely personable, and I would say between them are an excellent shop window for Zambia.
And has he been, I don't want to say set up, but I imagine he has a tough task. And do you think that Michael Sata maybe, you know, put him up for this post because there's certainly some tough discussions to be had with some of the Chinese investors in Zambia?
Very much so. And Michael Sata, in a previous election campaign, was very critical of the Chinese, actually said that they should leave Zambia. Zambia's relationship with China is fractious. The Chinese are mining most of the copper in Zambia, and 70,000 Chinese now live in Zambia. There's quite strong feeling that they are quite harsh employers. At the same time, Guy Scott was telling me today, you know, on one hand, the Zambians complain that the Chinese are very harsh employers. On the other hand, the Chinese complain that the Zambians are lazy, and really there needs to be a great deal of engagement there for things to move forward. Now, the Patriotic Front, which is their party, has tempered their arguments. I mean, there's no question of throwing out the Chinese now, but there's definitely a call for engagement. There's also a need to engage with other countries in the region. Malawi has a bad relationship. Malawi's current president has a bad relationship with Michael Sata due to an expulsion a few years ago. And I might add another interesting, very interesting, slightly diplomatic, strategically diplomatic point for the future is that Guy Scott told me today that when he was 16, he joined what became ZANU-PF, because in those days, that area of southern Africa was, of course, one large colony, or two, but northern and southern Rhodesia. He went to school in southern Rhodesia, and he met Robert Mugabe, who was 20 years older than him and who was a teacher, and Guy Scott, who was a student, 16, photocopying protest documents to circulate. And so he may also be an interesting player in negotiation moves with Zimbabwe, with a view perhaps to Robert Mugabe's retirement.
Great. Alex Duval-Smith in Joburg, en route back to Cape Town. Have a good flight. We'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And you can read that story from Alex when she gets it filed to us in our upcoming issue. You are listening to Midori House. It is just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour here in London. We are back in a moment.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25-25 City Guide series. With its unique timeshift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
You're back at Midori House with me, Tyler Berlay. We're in Studio One, where I'm joined by our creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, and also our fashion director, Takaharu Sato. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Thank you.
You've been having it easy, and we've been doing radio. You just had to sort of, you know, fix logos to sides of walls and, you know, and just coasting on your side of the room.
Yeah, it's a doddle, actually. I'm quite glad I'm just upstairs dealing with print and parties and invites and shops and opening cafes and all number of other art direction and creative direction projects. So,
but it kicks off from about tomorrow morning, though, because I was also talking to Jackie Deacon, who is our production director and is in charge of course, getting the magazine out on time and all the logistics and buying paper and all those things. And she said, I'm keeping my head down on this side of the office.
She won't be next week, I'm
no,
sure.
No, it's a beast. We're starting the process of closing over the next 10 days our biggest issue ever.
By some margin as well.
Yeah, it's going to be a beast. We haven't broken our paper record though. Jackie disappointed me. I think our record is 7 different paper stocks. She said we've only got 6.
Oh dear. Well, it's not too late, Tyler.
No, I know. I'm thinking, you know, there must be room for a poster or something that we can add to the mix. But you and Taki have been busy pulling together quite a big, epic, more models than we've ever used in a fashion shoot. And I thought, as this is the part of the program that we like to look at how we do things, I thought we'd start with you, Rich. You know, from your perspective, when rewinding exactly five years ago, we were just working on really the first dummies and refining what we were going to do with the magazine. What did you want to bring to the fashion mix?
We often get asked about the start of Monocle, and I think it was more a case of, you know, in many conversations you and I had, it was more that we knew things we didn't want to bring to the party. We didn't really want to pander to stylists, and we didn't really want to just fill up photographers' books with projects that they wanted to shoot. We wanted very much to have our own voice, and we didn't want anything too bombastic or overstyled, over retouched. We wanted something relevant that we liked, that we knew other people would like. Mm. And that's down to the photographic style, the choice of model, of course, the type of clothing, and just a general kind of nice, warm approach to models on clothes, which is essentially what a fashion shoot is.
And is that why you end up with this chap over here with Takaharu Sato? Is that why we went with a Japanese fashion editor?
Well, we like Japan, obviously. I'm not quite sure how we ended up with Take, but he's lasted.
Yeah, he certainly has. You've you've gone the distance. But would you agree with that, Take, that it was, as Richard was saying, it wasn't just about building the career of a photographer, but in part as well, I will say, sitting in the editor's chair, that it was about making the reader come first as well?
Yeah, I think so. I can totally agree with Rich. I have been working in this industry since almost 10 years. And then, you know, since Japan, actually.
Since you was 15.
Well, I'm not lying. Purely 10 years. I have worked with a lot of, you know, creative Japanese stylist photographers, as well as here in London, you know, different, you know, creative people in Europe. And then when I come across a lot of different magazines, you know, a lot of creative people tend to do, like, their sort of, you know, literally simply what they want to do, rather than what they would expect the readers to sort of come across. I think when we create fashion stories, it has to do with something, fashion consumption at the end of the day. This is my opinion. Mm. So I really like to sort of organize a more realistic fashion shoots.
Yeah, I think that would be our opinion too, wouldn't it, Rich? Not just Takis.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the litmus test is, would we want to buy it, wear it, steal it?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, yeah. there is quite a big shrinkage bill as well upstairs. No, but it is true. I think if it, you know, with it, every time, you know, you boys do a shoot, that everything is laid out, and I think, you know, if enough, you know, whether it's, you know, if enough guys upstairs, you know, pass the menswear, some also pass the women's wear and like it as well. But if enough guys pass the menswear and think, okay, this is something that, you know, when can I get a tacky? Can you get me a discount on this or whatever it is? You know, we're on to winner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one memorable shoot we did, actually, I don't think it was with you, Taco, but it was when we shot in Marseille with Alexis Armanet, I think way back in issue 4, I think.
That's not me.
It's probably why it went so down so well. But I remember there was a moment when I finished the layout and kind of half the guys in the office came round, and the consensus was they'd wear every garment in that shoot. And I think that's the kind of... That to me was a sort of crystallizing moment of this is what our fashion is about. Mm. And obviously we've built upon that with Take and other stylists. I mean, Akio has also been a part of that. He's our man in Japan. In Japan, not from Japan, and in London. And he is also, you know, follows the same merits and that vernacular. So it's been...
Maybe we should take it back to Japan. You've brought some music for us to listen to.
Yes.
A little something for us.
Yes, exactly. It's Prism by M-Flow.
Okay, let's have a listen. That was a very good choice, Take.
Yeah, like funk it up. Yeah. Funk it up.
It's quite old M-Flow, wasn't it, Prism? It's been around for a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
But still really fresh.
Yeah, very fresh. And this is even more fresh. This is a little sting that Verbal made for us over the weekend. This is some of our new Midori voices. We're back in a moment.
London Ball, as a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, es a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, βουρσε Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. That was not from Verbal. We'll play that one later. I think it's in the mix. It's loaded into the machine or the cart. I have to learn all this radio language. I'm not down with it yet, Rich.
You went past me when you said the word loaded.
I just want to go back to the story that you just shot. So I guess the brief was, and we were talking about, because of course the December-January issue is, well, it's our holiday lead-up issue. We've still got Alpino, which is our newspaper, which comes at really just almost on the eve of Christmas. But what was the concept and idea for the upcoming story you just shot?
It was a simple one. We just want to do something in studio, as we do. We travel with our fashion, but we also like to get back in studio. There's a directness when you're in studio, and we wanted to keep it very simple. And we just, this time out, we wanted to do more of a fashion portrait story. So we did a big cast. It's 12 different models, kind of probably 8 or 9 different nationalities. And new photographer, Emma Hardy, who's got a great sort of natural reportage style.
And you found her where?
We actually wanted to commission her for an expo about a year ago. Mm. And she just shot a lookbook.
She blew you out of the water.
She did. we couldn't quite get her. I can't remember. We couldn't get her on the dates or, you know, these things. Something didn't happen. It didn't get loaded in, basically.
Right.
But she's just, you know, she's someone that's always on our radar, or still on our radar, and we managed to get her for this. And we tweaked the story to make it, instead of it just being a standard studio shoot, we had the idea to include luggage, and then we started thinking... You know, we're an international mix here. People go home for the holidays. Some go for 2 weeks. Some go for the weekend. So we just made it a home for the holiday story. So it's a mixture of fashion and luggage as well. So it's a real, I think it's going to be, well, we've seen the results. It's very good. Taka did an amazing job on it, and as did Poppy. So I think the reader's going to really like this one.
Poor Taka is stifling a cough over there. Was it cold in the photo studio, or is it too cold in here for you?
It's from my fashion cupboard, getting dusty for the whole day, digging up lots of samples, boxes.
I've got my eye on that Remova sort of mini steamer trunk is quite nice.
Mm.
Now, I think that's what works really well about this, right? I just saw the Polaroids. And it's nice to say that we still have Polaroids floating around. It's not just looking at things off the iPhone.
No, absolutely. We push that wherever we can. We believe in film. We believe in analog. And we still try and shoot as much as we can when we can. And Emma, you'll be pleased to know, when we said, do you shoot film or digital? She's just said, I only shoot film.
Really?
Yeah, she hates digital. Mm. So I thought, yeah, you'll be very pleased about that.
I was going to ask you, I mean, have you noticed a shift at all? Because, of course, you know, so many photographers, of course, they want to embrace, you know, the latest and the newest. And, of course, they're on one side, we know there's maybe a speed and accuracy in the moment. But I think also what we found is that, you know, we want a film effect, and just the amount of post-production that has to go into a lot of digital work to take it back to what film could do in the first place. So has there been a settling down, or is the migration still to digital, or are there others like Emma out there?
I think there are others out there. It depends on their age. I think the worry is that the newer people coming in will only be digital. Mm. When we shoot, we've shot a couple of covers here at the Monocle office, and again shot film, but we struggle now to find assistants that can actually
load a camera,
yeah. So they can operate Photoshop or Capture One, but they can't actually load film, which is, you know, basic necessity when you're shooting film. So that's a bit of a struggle. And if that continues, it will just become harder to shoot film.
Mm. Rich, you've got two kids.
Well, yeah, I have.
I think train them up.
I'll get started, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
But Taka, you know, it's funny because when I was in Tokyo recently, and we'll certainly be covering this story quite a bit. That Tsutaya, one of our favorite stores, they're opening up a massive new bookstore in Tokyo in about 3 weeks' time, and one of the parts, or at least there'll be a little satellite off the main store, which is just going to be focusing on renting and developing. Renting 35mm cameras and then also developing as well, which I just think says something, you know, in many ways so right about the market, that there is this interest in people wanting to actually be able to work with analog photography.
Yeah, that's great. I think there's a lot of camera geeks out there in Japan. It's one of the
best
markets.
You don't say.
Yeah, you know, I know a lot of people who are keen on, like, you know, analog photography, mm-hmm. and then Japan is, I think, one of the best markets in mm-hmm. the world if you do that kind of business. And I think it's great that sort of, you know, sort of transforming the message that let's go back to the classic style of photography.
I mean, if you can speak for, if you can speak for 120 million other people, but you know, why is it in Japan that, you know, so let's say I was in Paris recently, and you go into an atelier of a company which just focuses on bespoke shoes, and the young people that you see in there are learning how to make, you know, bespoke footwear are young Japanese. You know, what is, and it's the same when you go to Florence as well. You know, you'll go to the cutting rooms of tailors. You know, you'll go to leather companies, and you see young Japanese. Why is, and it's just really off the back of what Jonathan was saying earlier, that you know, so he goes up to Stoke-on-Trent, and he's looking at people who are, of course, you know, trying to get back into the ceramics business as well. Why the sense of craft and wanting to do things by hand, and especially when it's a developed economy like Japan as well, mm. where young people don't really need to do these types of jobs?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I think it's something to do. Maybe we have something in our blood. We call it shokunin spirit, which is like a craftsman spirit. You know, pay sort of attention to the details and then make everything precisely from 0 to 100 complete to the completion. And young people are quite keen on sort of getting back to the sort of classic style of making things. Mm. And then, of course, you know, British tailoring or Italian sort of craftsmanship are very popular in Japan. And then once they get fascinated by the products, and they decide straight away, like, oh, okay, this is, you know, Florence, where, you know, all the great shoemakers are around. Mm. I'm going to go there to see what's happening. And if they like the town, food, people and everything, they start learning the language and then get the skills in the local factories. Mm. Yeah,
could be a fashion shoot that.
Actually, yeah, it's a very good idea. But it's amazing how many young Japanese that you see coming to Europe. Takara Sato, our fashion director, Richard Spencerville, our creative director. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Looking forward to seeing the results on page. That's all for Midori House. This is this Wednesday edition. And today's show was produced by Gillian Tobias, and our studio manager was Anna Veal. Nick Kelly is here with the headlines over the next few hours. And at 2200 London time, Rob Bound and Aisha Spears are here with the Monocle Daily. But next, it's the news, and then it's Jonathan Openshaw with The Entrepreneur. I'm back tomorrow morning with The Globalist, with a whole new raft of people, including John Owen. But for now, it's goodbye from Studio One here in London.